It is time for the Border News Roundup. Friday mornings, we get a chance to check in with Marshall Helmberger. He's the editor and the publisher of The Timberjay. It's a newspaper serving northeastern Minnesota. Thanks for being here, Marshall.
Happy to be here, Heidi.
Let's start off with a story you've been covering about the 2017 mining tax guide. Why did you want to cover this? What'd you find out?
Well, actually, it's something that we've kind of reported on regularly over the years. This guide is published annually by the Minnesota Department of Revenue, and it basically just provides a snapshot of the taxes that are generated by the taconite industry and where those monies go. A lot of that funding comes back to area schools and cities, counties, and also to the IRRB to fund economic development efforts. And, of course, a lot of that money, especially the production tax, is paid in lieu of property taxes. So, you know, it's supposed to cover funding for these local communities that would not otherwise be generating property tax revenue, you know, from those mining lands. It's not like they're necessarily paying additional money on top of that. But in either case, what was interesting is this kind of a trend that we actually first reported on about 3 years ago, which is that the amount of revenue that's being generated by taxes on the mining industry are continuing to kind of slip behind the rate of inflation. And that over the years, it's become fairly significant. And we certainly saw that this year again. And this year, the amount of taxes generated were down because production was down a fair bit. We had total tonnage of only 29 million tons in 2016, and that is lower than the long-term average, which is more in the upper 30s in terms of tonnage. And so we saw a fairly significant drop in taxes generated by the industry this past year. And there's a number of factors involved here. You know, the production tax has kind of not kept pace with inflation over the years. It has not kept pace with the increases in the price of a ton of taconite pellets. You know, for many years, taconite was selling for, you know, $15, $20 a ton. You know, in more recent years, it's been well above that. Yet the amount of production tax does not increase based on those increases in price. And then, of course, over the years, you know, the value of a dollar keeps declining, yet we don't seem to be seeing big increases or any substantial increases at all in the amount of money raised by the production tax. So the value of that money continues to slip. At the same time, we have a number of tax breaks that have been implemented by the legislature, including one in 2015, where they exempted the mining companies from sales taxes or use taxes on purchases of equipment. Those tax breaks have actually allowed a rebate of $13 million to the industry last year. And so that kind of further reduces, you know, the tax benefits that the region is receiving from the industry.
Let's move on to another story you've been covering. Last Thursday, there was a bill introduced by Representative Emmer from Southern Minnesota, the Miner Act. What happened with it, and what's the future of it look like?
Well, the bill did narrowly pass the House last Thursday, and this bill would have restored two federal mineral leases to Antofagasta, and that's the Chilean-based mining company that has proposed this Twin Metals mine near Ely. And it would also halt a two-year study of a proposed mineral withdrawal in the Superior National Forest. And that mineral withdrawal was proposed by the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management about a year ago. And basically, it would impact the area that Antofagasta was looking at mining. And so that would mean that for at least the next 20 years, there likely would be no more mineral leases issued in the area they had identified as an area they wanted to mine. So the impact on this would, you know, basically would have put that project on hold indefinitely. The bill, as passed by the House now, essentially would give that project new life. It would restore those mineral leases and end that two-year study of a withdrawal proposal. The final impact of this will probably be less than that, however, because it does not appear that it has any support or any substantial support in the Senate. There's been no companion bill introduced. From sources that we've talked to, it doesn't appear that that's going to happen. And there's sufficient, I think, attention to this particular issue nationally that it's unlikely to be something that is just going to get inserted in some larger bill at some point. So unless that were to happen, this issue is probably dead. And most people are anticipating at this point that this two-year study will go ahead and that at least for now, those mineral leases are going to be withdrawn. Now, of course, that case that's in court also. I mean, Antofagasta is suing federal government over that decision to cancel their two mineral leases. I would think that's unlikely. And if so, then those leases would have to be renewed through some other decision-making process. And that would likely require some additional environmental review before those leases could be renewed.
It's the Border News Roundup with Marshall Hellenberger. Marshall, another story you've been working on that has to do with those of us that live in northern Minnesota is a study that was done to find out what winter recreation, what's going to change with continued climate change. Tell us more about this.
Right. This was a study that was undertaken by an international consulting firm called ABT Associates. It's ABT Associates. They used a number of modeling scenarios to predict ongoing impacts from climate change on winter recreation in the U.S. And they looked specifically at the impact on downhill skiing, snowmobiling, and cross-country skiing. The impacts varied depending on the models that they used and some of the scenarios. But here in the upper Midwest, as well as the Northeast and the Pacific Northwest, they predicted very significant impacts to all of those winter recreation industries I just mentioned as early as 2050. So that's just basically 30 years, just over 30 years from today. So we could be seeing some rapid changes in these industries and to the point where some of these industries may not exist in the future. And basically the issue is that the season for these types of activities keeps getting shorter and shorter and that people then, invest in other types of activities during the winter. In northeastern Minnesota, winter recreation, while it's not, say, on par with the activity we see in the summer, it's still a fairly significant industry. I mean, snowmobiling is big, cross-country skiing is substantial. Downhill skiing is certainly has a major impact as well. And the study did include some of the downhill facilities here in northeastern Minnesota, including Giants Ridge, Spirit Mountain in Duluth, as well as Lutzen. So the impacts of these facilities is quite substantial in the economies of this region. And the thing with downhill skiing, too, just as you shorten the season, the economics of running a downhill ski resort become more and more challenging. And particularly, the study noted that, it's that period around the holidays, Christmas through the New Year's, that is really a key time that kind of determines the profitability of many downhill ski operations. And as the ability to make snow simply because temperatures are too warm is reduced over time, that's going to make it more and more years you're going to have such a situation where downhill operators are just not going to be able to have sufficient snow in time for those key periods of the year that they need to make a go of it. So you're going to end up probably seeing more and more of these operations shutting down. And in fact, that's what they predict. But it was interesting too. I also talked to Paul Shirky, and he and his wife operate the Wintergreen Dog Sled Lodge near Ely. And of course, the study didn't look at dog sledding, but up in our area, it's a fairly substantial little industry as well. And, in talking to him, he just, they've been in business for 35 years, and he said they've watched their season diminish by nearly 20% over that time. Back 35 years ago, their typical dog sledding season averaged 116 operating days. He said now it's down to about 94. And he's, they're actually fairly lucky, he said, because, dog sledding really only requires a few inches of snow, whereas, things like cross-country skiing and snowmobiling, they require a lot more of a substantial snow base. And one thing about cross country and snowmobiling, you know, unlike downhill skiing, you know, downhill ski facilities can make their own snow. That's obviously not practical for the snowmobile industry or for cross country skiing in most cases. So, you know, they really are dependent on the natural snow. And as we get less and less of that, and, you know, the season just gets shorter and shorter, you know, the impacts are going to be fairly substantial. And the numbers are big. I mean, in northeastern Minnesota, there have been some studies in the last few years about, you know, the economic impact of some of these industries. One study indicated that snowmobiling generates about $54 million in spending across northeastern Minnesota annually, and cross-country skiing generates about $17 million. Those are substantial numbers, and a statewide study that was done on the downhill ski industry put total spending at about $282 million. You know, so these are fairly big industries, and that spending also sparks other types of economic activity as well. So the impact of this could be substantial if we start seeing a significant reduction in this kind of activity.
Marshall, before we go, you also had a story on the changes of the deer permit areas.
Actually, the DNR, and I think we might have talked about this, that they did adjust the deer permit area boundaries in a good chunk of northeastern Minnesota, and that was to better align those boundaries with the primary moose range. And basically, the DNR, you know, through the recent research they've been doing, they've really come to the conclusion that the biggest threat to moose is higher densities of deer. And so what they are trying to do is manage deer populations within those zones in the primary moose range to keep the deer numbers down. And what they've essentially been doing is allowing hunters more flexibility. I mean, they were some of the first areas to go to hunter's choice. In fact, most of the permit areas now in the moose range this past season were designated as hunter's choice, which means hunters can take one deer of either sex. Hunters definitely took advantage of that in those permit areas, and now that they have the data from registrations, they can see that it had a big impact and that those permit areas in the moose range saw a substantially larger harvest of deer than some of the ones kind of on the periphery of the moose range, where the rules were not as permissive in terms of what hunters could take. So, you know, it appears that that's going to benefit the moose by keeping the deer population in the moose range suppressed. And that's basically the goal right now of the DNR. I mean, in most places, they manage to try to keep a relatively high deer population to, you know, pleases hunters, obviously. But in that moose range, they're going to try to keep the population down to around 4 to 7 deer per square mile, which is a pretty low density, certainly compared to a lot of other parts of the state where we see densities of 20 to 30 deer per square mile in many other parts of Minnesota. So that's pretty low deer numbers, and the research shows that that should help to reduce the impacts of things like brainworm and liver flukes and other, you know, parasites and diseases that deer carry that really impact moose. This is good news, I guess you could say.
Marshall Helmberger, it's the Border News Roundup. You can read and see more at timberjay.com. Marshall, thanks so much. We'll check in with you next week.
Sounds great. Thanks, Heidi.